This broadcast of The Independent is a production of the North Carolina Reading Service for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. And that edition is dated October the 23rd of 2025, and it is read today by John Federson. All right, hello, and here we go with the October 23rd issue of Indie Week, which is, by the way, indieweek.com. These stories can all be accessed through the internet at indie.com, a free website. Starting in Raleigh, about Raleigh, bus operators are frustrated by difficult and unsafe working conditions. Go Raleigh. Bus operators are concerned about what they say are unsafe conditions and mismanagement on the job. And they've been asking the Raleigh City Council for help since June. They brought up the issue again at the October 14th meeting. Bus operator Natalie Brown told the council during the public comment period, "Every day my co-workers and I perform one of the most essential, yet often overlooked public services. We transport thousands of residents safely to work, school appointments, and home again. We do this with professionalism and pride. However, I stand before you today because the working environment for operators has become increasingly difficult and, at times, unsafe." She said, "Operators feel unsupported and disrespected by management. We are seeking fairness, respect, and the right to a safe workplace." Go Raleigh drivers officially work for RATP, DEV, a large international company that operates more than 100 different local transportation systems, not the city of Raleigh. But the workers came to the council with their concerns because, as Go Raleigh employee James Limehouse said during public comment, "We move the city, and if y'all want us to continue to do this, then make it safe for us." Earlier this month, a Go Raleigh bus operator was arrested following an incident with a passenger. Her colleagues spoke up for her during the October public comment session, explaining that she was defending herself in an unsafe situation. Brown said incidents like this expose the gaps in our safety protocols and the inconsistent treatment of transit workers when they are the victims of violence. Brown's colleague Clifton Hill added, "We face daily threats, being cursed at, spit on, and even assaulted by passengers. We need real safety. We need transit police units that build relationships with operators and the community. Relations over intimidation." Bus operator Michael General said when it was his turn, "I don't think it's fair for me to be driving up the road, moving passengers, and getting cussed out and threatened. We're told to stay in our seats, shut up, and drive. At what point do you take your seatbelt off when someone is approaching you? We had an operator who was stabbed in the seat." In response to Indy's request for comment, an RATP Dev USA spokesperson wrote in an email that struck a concerned tone but was light on details. Quote, "We are aware of the concerns raised by the city and our employees. Go Raleigh drivers and staff perform an important and valued service for our community. Their safety and the safety of all riders as well as the general public is our number one priority at RATP Dev USA." The spokesperson added, quote, "In addition to our previously scheduled quarterly safety meetings with the Raleigh Police Department, our leadership team in Raleigh has been working with and will continue to work with the city, RPD, and Capitol Police, the private security company contracted by the city to provide officers at bus stations, on how to enhance safety measures, including facility safety, when it comes to public transport for passengers and drivers." The city of Raleigh sent Indy a nearly identical comment. "We are aware of the concerns raised by the employees." Andrea Epstein, communications supervisor for the transport department, wrote in an email, quote, Go Raleigh drivers and staff perform an important and valued service for our community. Their safety and the safety of all riders is something we take very seriously. Our staff has been working with and continues to work with RATP Dev on ways to enhance safety measures, including facility safety, when it comes to public transportation for passengers and drivers. Why, by George, excuse me, that was just about identical. Indy asked RPD what the enhanced safety measures would look like and whether ACORNS, that's Raleigh's co-response unit that pairs law enforcement with social workers, could be involved. Public Information Officer for the Police, David Davis, responded in an email, RPD already has something called hospitality units patrolling the downtown district, including near the Go Raleigh station, quote, allowing for faster response times and a greater visible presence to deter criminal activity and enhance public confidence. During the June meeting, Brown spoke about, quote, an escalated amount of violence on the bus, and asked for more support, quote, to ensure the safety of the men and women who move this city. At the June and October meetings, operators spoke about potential violation of their union's collective bargaining agreement. Go Raleigh operators are represented by ATU Local 1328, a branch of the Amalgamated Transit Union, which represents public transit employees in the U.S. and Canada. Indy has reached out to ATU for comment, and we will update this story if they respond. Next, a couple articles, a few actually, from Durham. Durham considers stiffer rules for unsafe rentals. The City Council is expected to vote on a provision intended to protect tenants living in unsafe conditions at its Monday night meeting. At its work session on October 9, the Council discussed a revision to the city's housing code that would prevent landlords from collecting rent on properties with, quote, imminently dangerous conditions, like unsafe wiring and severe pest infestations. Right now, Durham tenants can sue for rent abatement in small claims court if their landlords do not keep properties livable. Charlotte and Pittsburgh have similar provisions prohibiting landlords from collecting rent for unsafe units, but members of the Durham City Council and the city attorney have raised concerns about whether the proposed provision would be preempted by state law and open up the city to legal risk. Council member Chelsea Cook brought the proposal to the council at the urging of Riverside High School students and other advocates. Milo Graber started the Riverside High School Affordable Housing Club after he researched slumlords for an AP government project. Graber came across Charlotte's tenant protection ordinance and decided that Durham needed one too. He told the Indy, the people who that policy is going to affect are mostly young people, and so having young people advocate, I think, is a lot more powerful as a message, because it's saying even if we are not currently the ones in power advocating, we still care about this. Graber and other Riverside students wrote a report to the City Council and spoke at a previous work session meeting in collaboration with Cook. Cook works as an eviction defense lawyer and as an assistant professor of law at Duke. They said they regularly see clients struggling with unsafe living conditions. If the ordinance revision passes, Cook would like to pursue adding inoperable air conditioning and lack of airflow to that list of conditions because health risks during periods of high temperature are increasing in the South. Cook does not intend for the ordinance to remove people from the properties, as homelessness is also a severe health risk. It would only prevent landlords from collecting rent on the homes until the conditions are safer. Cook says, these habitability issues are really, really impactful to people's lives, and not only because it puts them into housing instability, it can also come with health concerns as well. So what this ordinance would allow is for an extra tool in the toolbox for renters and for tenant advocates. The city attorney's office sent out a memorandum in September raising concerns about the legality and enforcement of a rent prohibition provision because the topic may be preempted by state law. The state prohibits cities from regulating rent prices. Instead, the city attorney's office recommended the city pass an ordinance listing conditions that make a property unsafe for human habitation and produce a campaign to educate renters on their pre-existing right to rent abatement for unsafe conditions. If the council chooses to move forward with a clause, the city attorney recommends adopting a list of unsafe conditions and adding language prohibiting occupancy of units found to meet those conditions. North Carolina Tenants Union submitted a memorandum supporting that revised ordinance. General Counsel Italo Medelius argued that the city government does have the authority to enforce this ordinance and, quote, the General Assembly has expressly delegated to cities the power to regulate housing conditions. Next from Durham, the second No Kings rally draws thousands. It wasn't just a protest against authoritarianism, it was a rally for workers. Speakers included a variety of union representatives and the Reverend Dr. William Barber II. The first No Kings protest, a nationwide push to bring as many people as possible out to protest President Donald Trump, was held last June. Durham's June No Kings event at CCB Plaza was organized by local individual organizers. This time, a variety of groups came together to organize and support that protest, which they dubbed No Kings, No Billionaires. Thousands gathered at Durham Central Park, one of about 2,500 such events that took place across the country Saturday, and drew an estimated 7 million participants. Attendees were concerned about ICE raids, free speech, workers' rights, voting rights, and Palestinian liberation, among other issues. In Durham, Barber, a theologian, professor, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, and member of the National NAACP Board of Directors, emphasized the importance of unity and the undue influence of billionaires on the federal government. Quote, extremism empowered billionaires to illegally cancel funding for programs that Congress had already approved this election and set up a precedent to abuse his power to impose taxes on Americans through tariffs. It created a political alliance that passed the largest transfer of wealth from poor and low-wage Americans to rich Americans since the transfer of wealth from slaves to the slave masters. They slashed Medicaid, tripled funding for ICE, and unleashed an assault on American communities, said Barber. The event was endorsed by many groups. Labor South, Common Defense, Black Workers for Justice, Bull City Indivisible, and many, many, many others. Catherine Pollack is the founder of Engaged Durhamites for Democracy. That's a group that has held 17 to 20 demonstrations per week since it was founded in February. Pollack said that concerns and fears over Trump administration policies have grown since the last No Kings event, and that focus on labor made this event different from the previous one. Quote, one of the things I think was so beautiful about this demonstration was, again, that it was bringing unions and the grassroots organizations together because we have a common mission. We are fighting fascism that's funded by billionaires, and the billionaires are hurting workers. I would say that a lot of people who are fighting fascism haven't been paying attention to billionaires. They haven't been paying attention to the plight of the workers. According to Pollack, an estimated 6,000 to 7,000 people attended the event. The June rally, which Pollack helped organize, drew a crowd of roughly 5,000. After the crowd listened to speakers and did call-and-response cheers on the hill of Durham Central Park, it took to the streets, led by union workers. The protesters marched through downtown before wrapping back around to the park for a smaller teach-in and spontaneous speeches by community members. Many attendees who spoke to Indy said they had also attended the June protests, though many were concerned about speaking with the media. Jonathan, an attendee who preferred to be identified only by his first name, said he had even attended another No Kings event Saturday before attending this in Durham, saying, "We were at the Raleigh event, and it's just more lined up on the side of the road, so I really like this vibe a lot better. This is a lot more active, a lot more visible." Many other attendees were wearing inflatable costumes, including several axolotls, an elephant, and a duck. Retired pharmacist Susan Monpetit, dressed as a panda bear as an ode to protesters in Portland, Oregon, where people dressed as inflatable frogs and other critters have been staring down ICE agents. But Monpetit said things had changed since the last time she came out. "Then," she said, "it seemed like it was on the edge. Now we've fallen off the edge. We are falling, free-falling. So it's imperative, like today, to come together even stronger. Hopefully, coming together like this, we can figure out who we are and what we're doing together. The more we talk, the better." There's another feature article from Indie Week that I'm going to tell you about, and I may not be able to read it today. It's very, very long, and it's about Gear Cemetery over in Durham, a historically African-American cemetery that's fallen into disrepair. And there are many efforts now to begin, updating and cleaning and restoring some of the data represented at that cemetery. But as I said, it's very long, and I have to get on, I think, to some other more immediate articles, and so here I go. Apex Environmental Advisory Board has okayed conditions for a proposed data storage facility. Pardon me. At the heart of the debate over whether Apex should annex and rezone a parcel of land located in New Hill, just south of old U.S. Highway 1, for a proposed data storage facility is a central question. Do town leaders envision that property as a corridor for future industrial growth, or do they want it to remain rural pasture land? If it's the former, developer Michael Natelli argues his company's proposed New Hill Digital Campus is an ideal use for the site. If it's the latter, he says, his business here is done. The town's long-range planning documents, including its comprehensive plan, have identified the site for industrial use for at least the past decade, but it is currently zoned for low-density residential. On Thursday evening, the Town of Apex Environmental Advisory Board, the EAB, working on the assumption that leaders are still planning for that industrial use, voted 6-3 to side with Natelli after his company, Natelli Investments, submitted rezoning conditions aimed at addressing the environmental impacts of the project, including sound pollution, water and electricity usage, and the presence of diesel-fueled generators proposed for the site. The board is composed of volunteers with expertise in conservation, environmental engineering, land use, and related areas. The board's approval of the rezoning conditions is non-binding, but indicates a favorable recommendation of the proposal to the Apex Town Council based on environmental impacts when the council considers that rezoning. If the conditions are met, the town's planning board will weigh in on the land use, and the town council will ultimately decide whether to grant the rezoning to industrial use. Continued opposition from residents is expected. In an interview ahead of that board meeting earlier this week, Natelli told Indy that he recognizes the proposal would be a major change for the area, but the town is going to stick with its plan. If the town is going to stick for an industrial use for the site, a data storage facility would be less disruptive than a manufacturing plant, recycling facility, or distribution warehouse, for example. He says the company will go beyond basic requirements for buffers, setbacks, and vegetation to minimize light and noise pollution, and at the board meeting he committed to regular sound testing and monitoring, saying, "We're trying to work in a collaborative way with the town, with the community." Still, the impacts of emerging data storage facilities used to power technology and increasingly powerful AI are being felt across the country. Large facilities like this one use staggering amounts of electricity and in some cases water, and for many Americans living close to them, the quality of life issues are real. EAB member Katie Schaff, one of the dissenting voters, said at the meeting, "As a founding member of this board, I don't think there could possibly be enough zoning conditions to mitigate the negative effects of this proposal." Natelli acknowledges there is a lot of negative media coverage about data centers, much of it, quote, rightly so, because there are a lot of projects that for one reason or another should be scrutinized for certain reasons. But he disagrees with the premise that data centers, quote, are bad all the time. Certain areas like this, I feel, are very compelling for centers. Other areas are not. If we can start looking at things on a project-by-project basis, I do think we can find a way to mitigate a lot of the concerns that are out there if people are willing to have an open mind about it. Here's a look at the plans for the facility so far, some of the issues under discussion, the community concerns, and how the developer has proposed to address those in the rezoning conditions. Electricity. There's no getting around it. The data centers are power intensive, and this one especially so, with a request for 300 megawatts from Duke Energy. For context, that's about a third of the total energy output of the nearby Sharon Harris nuclear plant. Natelli submitted a load study to Duke this spring, and Natelli says the company feels comfortable asking for that much power. Transmission lines already exist that could link the property to Sharon Harris, and the developer would pay for any infrastructure upgrades needed. But residents worry the massive usage would cause their power bills to surge. Natelli says the facility would not be taking power directly or exclusively from Sharon Harris, but from several different plants that serve Duke Energy's grid, and the utility would figure out how to supply the 300 megawatts incrementally. Natelli says Duke is evaluating the ability for them to serve our requested load, as well as what impacts that load might have on the system of transmission and any upgrades required to the system, the extension of power, the substation, switching stations. We have to bear the cost of all that. It's a very, very big commitment, but it's a commitment that we're making, and we're not pushing that cost onto other people in Apex. But a recent report from Bloomberg found that wholesale electric costs up to 267% more than it did 5 years ago in areas located near data centers, especially in Northern Virginia and Maryland, where Natelli is based, where data centers are highly concentrated. The report states it's an increasingly dramatic ripple effect on the AI boom as energy-hungry data centers send power costs to records in much of the U.S., pulling everyday households into paying for the digital economy. In North Carolina, as Duke Energy evaluates its capacity to provide power for data centers planned statewide, there's a possibility that the state's utility commission will have to raise rates on all consumers. But the town of Apex has its own local distribution and transmission rates. Natelli says, "We're not touching that. There's nothing we're doing that's going to influence the retail rates that the town is charging Apex residents." Next, water usage. Part of the draw of the New Hill site is the proximity to Western Wake Regional Water Reclamation Facility. That's a wastewater treatment plant jointly owned by the town of Apex and Cary that's situated just a few hundred feet from the property. With the plant, an 18 million gallon per day facility with a reclaimed water system already on site, a prospective client would have the option to use non-potable treated wastewater between 500,000 and 1.5 million gallons per day for cooling inside the data storage facility. It's likely the water would only be used for cooling during the hottest months, said Natale representatives. And the new facility could provide on-site storage for the treated wastewater in the case of emergency. It's also likely that an end user for the site wouldn't require water at all, as some companies have shifted to using air or fluid cooling systems for their equipment. Craig Walsleben, a consultant for Natale, says a lot of users are moving away from using water altogether. If the site does end up using wastewater, about a third of that would evaporate during the cooling process. And Walsleben said, we would have to evaluate ecological impacts. Diesel generators. Natale's proposal calls for 80 3-megawatt backup generators to be located on the site. Each would be housed inside a tractor-trailer-sized storage container with a diesel fuel tank stored underneath. The diesel generators have been a source of anxiety for residents. Burning diesel, a fossil fuel, releases nitrogen oxide, sulfur oxide, carbon monoxide, and particulate matter into the atmosphere. Michelle O'Connor, a resident of the neighboring Jordan Point community, at the regularly scheduled town council meeting this week, said air pollutants are silent killers. These particulates are a unique threat, as they are not only are capable of penetrating lung and olfactory tissues, but are small enough to cross the blood-brain barrier. There is no exposure level that is considered safe, just levels that are considered acceptable. In their zoning condition, Natale pledges to use Tier 4 equivalent generators, which are designed to meet the U.S. EPA's strictest emission standards. They are the most energy efficient and have particulate filters and internal processes to treat emissions, says Natale. The generators would all need to be permitted to meet standards set by EPA and the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality, and they would be used rarely. The facility would be running on higher voltage transmission power lines rather than regular residential distribution lines. Walsleben explained, and transmission power lines are less impacted by weather or other emergencies that tend to knock out power. The final segment of this is noise pollution. For a few of the EAB members and for some members of the community, concerns over noise associated with the generators, cooling equipment, and other aspects of the facility are some of the most pressing. Natale has sought to address potential noise impacts in its conditions in several ways. First of all, the company wants to work with the town of Apex to create a more robust noise ordinance that will provide an objective way to measure noise output and make sure the facility is in compliance. In addition to doing its own sound evaluations, the company committed at the board meeting to pay to an independent consultant hired by the town to work on sound attenuation and testing measures. Increased setbacks, the company's representative said, will also help, as will buffers with vegetation. Natale told Indy, we are going to implement design measures like berming and landscaping and noise fencing if required. There are attenuation measures that can be built around the equipment. We're fully committed to doing whatever we need to ensure that the sound is not causing a problem and that it's at levels that are deemed acceptable. He adds that at the property line, the noise could, at 55 or 60 decibels, sound like a normal conversation. The company plans to study how the sound travels to nearby neighborhoods like Jordan Point. Natale says it'll hopefully put a number of people at ease. While the residents in attendance vocally disagreed, it did seem to put the majority of the EAB members at ease. Board member Bill Jensen said the digital campus could provide an opportunity for more Apex residents to work where they live rather than commuting to Raleigh or elsewhere. And before making a motion to approve the zoning conditions, he said, I'll be frank. I think this property is a decent area for light industrial. I'm sorry, I know that's probably going against the grain, but if you do these things right and you make a live-work situation, then everybody can benefit. And that's the critical thing, and that's what we're trying to do, is make this thing right. Well, and that's an article from Apex and their government, which is trying to decide things. And we'll move over to Wendell's Board of Commissioners for this article. Front runners for the commissioner's seats have different visions for growth. Many Wendellians, including several of the eight candidates running for three seats on the town board of commissioners, tell a similar story about what attracted them to the small but growing Eastern Wake County town. B.J. Barham, a first-time candidate and a frontman of American Aquarium. Once I saw the geographical area, I was like, this is exactly where I want to start and raise a family. We found a 1938 Dutch colonial in the middle of downtown Wendell, and we moved into a really amazing neighborhood. To be able to be 10 miles from the epicenter of one of the fastest-growing cities in America and still feel so far removed from it just by driving 15 minutes to the east, it's a beautiful, best-of-both-worlds situation. Candidate Dustin Ingalls also moved to Wendell to put down roots. 4 years ago, I was living in downtown Raleigh with roommates renting, and I was 36, he says, and I started thinking, what would it take to buy a house? Can I afford it? In Raleigh, the answer was a resounding no, so he ventured further afield. I was like, oh, this is a cute little downtown. The vibe here is all local businesses. There's no chain restaurants to be seen. This felt like a place I could be. Also, the house was affordable. That's the main part. Barham and Ingalls may both have been wooed by Wendell's small-town charm, but from there, their paths to local candidacy diverge. Barham, a Democrat, is running as part of what he calls a unity ticket with Republican former Commissioner Philip Tarnowski and unaffiliate candidate Kate Benson. Their slate is generally skeptical of Wendell's recent growth. For example, the town's population has almost doubled in the last 5 years to over 17,000, making it one of the fastest-growing municipalities in the nation, and believes the Board of Commissioners should be more selective in approving new development. His entry into local politics was as a neighborhood advocate, arguing against the development of 8 three-story townhomes across the street from his historic home. He and his neighbors were unsuccessful, and the property was rezoned earlier this year. Barham says, we live in one of the fastest-growing towns in one of the fastest-growing counties, in America. It would be naive to think that growth is not coming. I would like to see the high-density townhomes and apartments not entering into established neighborhoods, not entering into our historic district. We do need to address infrastructure, schools, medical facilities. We need to worry about revitalizing our downtown. Barham says the past decades have been marked by growth for the sake of growth in Wendell, with the Board of Commissioners rubber-stamping developments that don't benefit current residents. Ingalls, the director of North Carolina political programs like the Environmental Defense Fund, and a former political consultant, is more inclined to embrace the growth. He points out that new tax dollars can be reinvested into local businesses, infrastructure, and the economy, and that building more densely in the heart of Wendell helps to preserve forested area and farmland at the edge of town. Saying, a lot of people think historic preservation and growth are incompatible, that you pave over paradise when you grow. But in some ways, you need growth, need population and tax-based growth to maintain your history. I moved here largely because I couldn't afford to live in Raleigh and fell in love with the town, and I want to be a part of shaping it for years to come. But sometimes I feel like people would have shut the door in my face if they could have. Barham and Ingalls aren't the only candidates talking about Wendell's growth. It's the animating issue of this election, with implication for housing affordability, infrastructure, and the future of downtown. It's not a question of whether Wendell will continue to grow, but how. Deans Eatman, Deputy Secretary at the NC Department of Natural Resources, a first-time commissioner, and the only incumbent in the race. Two other commissioners, Jason Joyner and John Lutz, are not seeking re-election. Eatman says, a high-level growth philosophy that I have, if you're going to have growth, it should happen in places where it's connected. And there are amenities like downtown business district, wastewater system, stormwater, transportation infrastructure. Since Eatman was elected in 2021, the Board of Commissioners had adopted a new comprehensive plan, created a downtown social district, funded a new community center, and competitive pay adjustments for town staff, adopted a non-discrimination ordinance, and begun requiring developers to have community meetings during the rezoning process. Eatman pushes back against Barham's rubber-stamping characterization, saying, there are a ton of growth and development proposals that get brought to our staff and either never see the light of day or look so unrecognizable by the time that they do. Eatman, along with Ingalls, is endorsed by the Wake County Democratic Party. Like Barham, Benson and Tarnowski are campaigning for, quote, responsible growth that honors our roots, as Benson phrases it on her website. She tells Indy Wendell is, quote, not asking developers to do as much as we want them to, and has made it way too easy to pop up a neighborhood and then ask the Department of Transportation to handle the resulting traffic. Tarnowski puts it more bluntly. All we have here right now is high density. There's no room. Everything's on top of each other, and it hasn't made the price go down. U.S. Census Bureau data confirms that permits for new housing in Wendell has spiked in the last decade from 19 units authorized in 2013. 19 units, 1,050 authorized in 2023. But single-family development dominates that market. Of the 4,500 units authorized in that span of 11 years, 3,600 were single-family and 900 were multifamily. Barham, Benson, and Tarnowski are campaigning energetically as a unit. Barham says the fact that he and his running mates aren't taking money from developers reflects their commitment to regular residents of Wendell. Barham has raised about $4,300 this election, Benson about $1,300. Tarnowski doesn't expect to raise more than $1,000, so he hasn't reported any donations, saying, I think a lot of people are excited that I'm not a career politician. I don't have any aspirations of being a senator. I'm a rock and roller who cares about my hometown. Of the remaining five candidates, Jorge Cordova has raised $700, and Christopher Kritzer has not reported any donations. Eatman has raised about $5,000 as the most recent reporting deadline. Ingalls has raised $29,500 and Wes Jones about $25,000. Jones is now an attorney for the NC General Assembly's House Oversight and Government Operations Committee. He's a, quote, founding member of High Point University's law school and a creative writer. The author bio for his self-published poetry book describes him as an ungentle when holding a flower, subtly managerial and, quote, aware of his own existence. That's the author bio. According to the Board of Elections in the state, he voted in Guilford County last year and has never voted in Wake County, suggesting a recent move. Despite this unorthodox path to local candidacy, Jones has secured an endorsement from the Wake GOP and raised the second highest amount of any candidate. He did not respond to Indy's interview request. Cordova seems to be a growth skeptic. His campaign website emphasizes avoiding gridlock, infrastructure strain, and loss of charm. He is endorsed by the GOP and has been canvassing in Wendell with Turning Point Action. Kritzer owns an anesthesia business and a restaurant in neighboring Knightdale. On his campaign Facebook page, he focuses on traffic, public safety, and supporting Wendell's small businesses. Kritzer is suing the town of Wendell, the Wendell police, and a town police officer who, Kritzer claims, quote, allowed a marching band to perform outside Kritzer's residence after midnight. And then when Kritzer investigated the noise, quote, armed only with a golf club and a concrete tool for protection, falsely arrested Kritzer on accusations of assault and resisting arrest. The case was moved to federal court this summer. He declined to comment for this story. Cordova did not respond for the Indy's request for comment before publication. We will update the story if he does. Aside from the fraught issues of population growth and housing, many of the Board of Commissioners Andy spoke to brought up the same topics. The need to attract more small business to downtown, to protect the open spaces around Wendell, and to make sure roads and other infrastructure keep up with growth. Eatman added that the Board of Commissioners' day-to-day work is much less controversial than election season makes it seem. He says it's easy to lose sight of this sometimes, but we all live here. We all love Wendell. On November 5th, I hope we're still going to live here, and we're all going to still love Wendell. And a reminder, early voting in Wake County began October 16th and runs through November the 1st, and Election Day is the 4th. Find out more information on where and how to vote. If you do not know, there have been some changes, as I hope we realize. Well, on my recording studio clock, it's 2:30, and it's been quite a few hours since I had food, and so I'm going to read a couple food things. First, though, is a nonprofit modeled after the D.C. Central Kitchen is opening in the Triangle. And this is oriented, I think, towards Durham. However, here we go. Food insecurity is on the rise in the state. Nearly 14% of people in Durham County struggle with food insecurity. And between January of 24 and January of this year, SNAP participants had increased by 84,000 residents, according to the caseload data from the state. This spike occurred shortly before Trump signed the One Big Beautiful Bill Act into law, tightening parameters on SNAP eligibility and cutting off an estimated 2.5 million Americans from food aid. One thing there isn't a shortage of, though, is food waste. In 23, there were over 2 million tons of food waste generated by North Carolina alone. Both of problems that Michael Woods, the founder of Triangle Central Kitchen, TCK, is excited to tackle with his recently launched nonprofit. He stresses, "We are a nation that has the potential to solve our hunger crisis that hasn't. I don't think too many people need to have it explained to them how dire the need is in this particular moment for work that touches at the intersection of hunger and poverty." TCK's goal is to launch its first pilot training program in the summer of 2026. A number of local organizations, including Porch Durham, Farmer Food Share, Durham Community Fridges, work to increase local food access. The problem, says Corey Williams, director of marketing at TCK, is scale. She says Feedwell Fridges did about 6,000 meals last year. While that's a significant amount of food, it's not enough to solve the area's deep hunger problem. And she says a lot of our community partners are like that, where they're able to do thousands of meals over a year, but we're hoping that by creating this central kitchen, we're able to help everyone scale. TCK's operations are modeled after the D.C. Central Kitchen, DCCK. That's a well-known nonprofit that prepared a staggering 4 million meals to help with food insecurity in the Washington area in 2024, 3.9 million meals. DCCK was founded in 1989 by Robert Egger, now a board member for TCK. Its premise and TCK's is simple but powerful. Use surplus food from farms and restaurants that would otherwise go to waste. Prepare a large number of meals at a dedicated central kitchen every day and distribute them to those who need them. But you need a big team to make thousands of meals a day. TCK's ultimate distribution goal. To solve for this, the nonprofit says it will offer paid training programs for aspiring chefs, helmed by culinary director and local powerhouse chef Ade Karena. These budding chefs will put their new skills to use by making all the meals while they're going through the program. Williams explains, "We're first and foremost a workforce development program. We're focused on trying to get folks into careers that are sustainable and provide living wages." Training cohorts will complete a roughly 11-week training program and also have access to things like externship opportunities and job placement support. TCK's model is set up so that ideally everyone involved benefits. Restaurants don't have to throw out perfectly good ingredients. Community members get fed and people get set up for long-term career opportunities. Right now, the nonprofit is busy fundraising and getting the word out about its mission. But it has not been a hard sell to get chefs like Saltbox Seafood's Ricky Moore committed to helping that program succeed. And Moore will serve as a board member as well as culinary general, according to Woods, a role that the pair is still defining. Moore says of his decision, "I do want to always explore how I can help, how I can participate and effect some change in the community. That's what I've always done, and that's what I'm always going to plan to do." And Woods says, "This work is truly needed now more than ever. We're certainly hoping to point a new way forward to how this work can be done with dignity and joy in the triangle." Okay, here is a article that I've held over for close to a month, and it's about Lawrence Barbecue relocating to Cary, North Carolina. And it goes this way. After only a year of operating out of Boxyard RTP, Lawrence Barbecue owner Jake Wood knew his highly acclaimed restaurant was outgrowing its small shipping container space. And yet, for roughly 2.5 more years, his team figured out ways to make things work, quote, "bending over backwards to attack the volume we faced," he says. But a lack of space isn't an issue he'll have to contend with for now, at least, because on September 19th, it reopened, and its new space on Cedar Street in downtown Cary, an expansive 5,000-square-foot space that includes a large indoor dining and bar area, an outdoor patio, dedicated bathrooms, none of which the previous location had. Wood had gotten several opportunities to move to a bigger space, but none felt like the right move. He says that when the opportunity for this new location popped up, the city was initially not on his radar. "We were never thinking Cary at all," he explains. "It wasn't a place we came to because, for forever, there wasn't really much around." Where has he been going? That all changed when he finally paid the empty space a visit and saw just how much the city had grown. It was a Wednesday afternoon, and the old, sleepy Cary he remembered from growing up was gone. "It was hot," he says, "of how busy downtown was during the middle of the week. I had no idea a lot of this stuff was happening." The impression gave him and his wife, Brandy, the confidence to finally take the leap and move from their cramped shipping container quarters to Cary. He says, "It's like what Lawrence Barbecue was meant to be when I was thinking of it 6 years ago, and now we're here." He had opened an RTP in the summer of 2021 and had spent years in the fine dining world at the now closed Plates Neighborhood Kitchen and 18 Seaboard before, but felt compelled to dive into the more casual world of barbecue. He says, "That's what I did at home when I wasn't at work. If I was cooking, grilling, smoking, using my little Walmart smoker out back." He noted that he learned how to make barbecue by reading books and watching YouTube videos. He's quick to point out that he does things differently than most, serving different styles of barbecue under one roof, focusing more on whether people are smiling, and if his team is enjoying themselves, then focusing on, say, how a brisket should be done. That laid-back backyard mentality is at the center of Wood's ethos, which is all about chilling out and enjoying yourself. The mindset shows up throughout the space in various ways, but is especially obvious in his menu, which features a seemingly eclectic mix of barbecue, oysters, and tacos, which shouldn't make sense together, but do. He says people love oysters, people love barbecue, people love tacos, and we've created a way that they all work together. At the root of it is just like finding joy, having fun, being relaxed, and enjoying yourself. Whatever you want to come in here and do, I think we can touch on that. One of our slogans is, proudly serving all y'all and everybody for all seasons at the same time. Wood keeps many of the fan favorites from the original location, like his wildly popular brisket and quesabirria tacos, Duke oysters from his friends at North Sea Oysters in Topsail Beach, and smoked meat platters. New addition, like the chili crisp cheese tots, smothered with a roasted poblano queso and barbecue shrimp cocktail, will join the menu in Kerry. Woods says he likes the new tortas using Mexican bolillo rolls for bread better than the tacos. He's also carrying over his signature leisure beverages for the bar program, including the Leisureland Lager from Trophy Brewing. We just wanted to have really simple, boozy, delicious beverages that are fun and that had fun names, he says, noting that their frozen nices will return in the spring to the menu. There's a lot to love, both about the way Wood operates and the kind of food he makes. And now that he's won over by Kerry, his enthusiasm for what he hopes to build for the community is infectious. He says, our goal, our only goal, is to just become a staple in the community and be a go-to for people for all different reasons. I just really want to get involved and play a part in all the special things that happen in Kerry. Another new opening recently, the wine bar Saint-Pierre. There are roughly 200 different types of wines on the shelves at the newly opened Saint-Pierre Wine Shop and Bar in Raleigh's Iron Works, where there are many common varietals on offer, like Merlot and Pinot Noir, that will be familiar to most. There are also wines that I've never heard of, including this Cinsault I'm currently sipping on. It's outside of my norm, they claim, to be drinking wine at 10 a.m. on a Thursday, but I've crashed one of the shop's weekly tastings that owners Anthony and Brett Guerra, also the duo behind the popular Oakwood Pizza Box and newly opened Capital Pizza Box, and partner Scott Hardiman, former sommelier at the Umstead and the opening general manager at East End Bistrot, hope to figure out whether wines make it onto the shelves or not. Anthony says, we're really trying to have our wall of wine be alive. You'll see it rotating and shifting, and you'll see some fun and different things. In the retail portion of the space, which opens September the 10th, shoppers will find four shelves of wine, with a heavy emphasis on wines that are under $60. Thank you. Price points generally start around $25 to $40 for the lowest shelf, under $60 for the next shelf up, with two more expensive shelves up top. The hardest wines to find, Anthony says, are the ones on the bottom shelves. Hardiman agrees. The goal, he says, find wines that over-deliver at a lower price point and are all in their own categories, so you don't have four wines that are competing really for the same kind of person. Each section of a shelf only has room for 10 different wines, so competition is stiff. Each pick needs to be purposeful and delicious and fit the desired price point. But while Anthony and Hardiman both agree on making sure Saint-Pierre is full of high-quality wine, there's plenty they don't agree on, which can make what deciding what wines pass the test even harder. Anthony says, laughing, Scott and I have opposite palates. I know the wine reps get a kick out of the two of us together. He continues, Scott loves Merlot, and I can't stand it. Big, oaky, woody, fluffy, chubby reds are not my thing. Heidemann smiles in such a way that it's obvious that the two of them have had this conversation before, noting that Anthony's interest in Italian white wines is something he disagrees with. I'd rather stay in France, he says. Italy should just focus on reds. That's my hot take. Today, we taste 11 wines. It's hard work, but someone has to do it. Some of the wines are automatic no's for the store. Some are a maybe that the team will keep in mind for the future, and a select one or two get the stamp of approval. As for the Cinsault, I'm going to spell that C-I-N-S-A-U-L-T. It's a strong contender to show up on the shelves soon, or at least be waiting in the wings. It's a light, easy-to-sip red wine, and one I would have never picked up myself, but a variety I'll be on the lookout for moving forward because of how much I liked it. This is one of the goals Anthony and Heidemann have, to introduce people to varieties they're unfamiliar with, varieties that could quickly turn into favorites. It's a requirement for St-Pierre staff to be passionate about wine and excited to chat with customers so that they can help them figure out the perfect bottle to buy. In addition to that large retail section that takes up the length of one wall, a sleek white marble bar where you can sit and sip a glass or two runs the majority of the opposite wall. St-Pierre is teaming up with popular chef Vivian Howard to bring in snacks, starting in the coming weeks via Howard's Viv's Fridge business. Anthony has been a longtime fan of Howard, so is Anthony's lovable golden retriever, Pierre, for whom the bar is named. He recounts, my first memory of a Viv's Fridge. Pierre is a puppy. We stopped in at a Viv's Fridge, and me and the dog are eating her pickled shrimp, driving home. Pierre loves food, so I would eat a shrimp, and he would eat a shrimp. Those pickled shrimp may make an appearance just like the Cinsault, but if not, rest assured that you'll find something to love at St-Pierre. Once again, this wine bar, St-Pierre Wine Shop and Bar in Raleigh's Ironworks. Well, and with 2 minutes to go, I will get you as much as I can out of a drama of Skyfuls of Birds in Durham. It's Tuesday evening at the Velvet Hippo's rooftop bar. From the wooded deck, a few dozen hipster bargoers admire a picture-perfect view of downtown Durham. City hall, churches and restaurants, illuminated by warm streetlights, folks sprinkled on the brick-laden sidewalks of West Orange Street, green trees speckled with orange, hinting at their incoming autumnal costume. Perfect, until they hear the discordant chirps that quickly evolve into a long, drawling screech. Then they look up to the periwinkle and pink skies where hundreds of birds funnel